I'm Eric Allen for KLCC. Peter Lawfer has led a distinguished career as an author, journalist, and broadcaster. He's also currently the James Wallace Chair in the School of Journalism and Communications at the University of Oregon. The latest of his many diverse books is Slow News, a manifesto for the critical news consumer, which parallels the slow food movement and Michael Pollan's guidelines in that arena. Peter Lawfer joins me in the KLCC studios. Welcome, Peter.
It's great to be here, Eric.
Well, since your career with NBC and CBS Radio took you all over the globe, I'd say that the news media has changed significantly more than the news. Would you agree with that?
We are bombarded by these dump truck loads full of whatever it is. Information, I guess, is an acceptable term. And that makes it much harder for us as individuals to figure out what it is that's important to us, I think. And also, we've lost this curriculum of common knowledge because we don't sit down in front of Huntley Brinkley anymore or Walter Cronkite and get this established, here is the agenda. That's, of course, good in some ways, but it also allows us to self-select to the point where maybe we don't know where Ukraine is.
I would say one of the things about that fragmentation that's interesting, too, is that we can self-select in a way that only shows us people who agree with our own viewpoint. I presume you see that as an issue as well?
Absolutely. So the book is, as you know, a list of rules with some stories behind why these rules are important. And one of those rules is exactly that. Go out and consume news that's reported and written or broadcast by those with whom you absolutely disagree. I force myself to listen not just to you guys, but 5 minutes a week is about all I can tolerate of Rush Limbaugh and the very nice guy up the street whose name escapes me. What's the guy up in Portland who's the Limbaugh local for the Northwest? He came out of the U of O too. What's his name?
I'm afraid.
Okay, we'll get it before the end of this.
Well, how do you decide then what to trust among these many news media sources that are so fragmented now, and it's not as easy to figure out who's behind that electronic curtain, I would say. And the standards are considerably different. From a slow news perspective, how do you measure that? How do you find the right sources?
Well, you take some time consuming different stuff from different places, and then trust the news that you're getting over time from specific outlets. So if you are paying attention to a story, and as it develops, you can see that a source is making a good attempt and often successfully reporting what's going on for you, then that's something to embrace. The other trick is if you know the story yourself, intimately, you've experienced it, you were part of it, you observed it, you studied it, and then you cross-check it against a news outlet, you can be pretty sure if they are going to treat you well with something you don't know anything about.
Let's talk a little bit about how slow news and slow food parallel each other for those who might not be familiar with either movement. Talk in general terms about what that means.
Well, the slow food movement, which is pretty well known, is let's enjoy our dinner and not just go through the drive-thru and stuff it down our throat and have some sense of what tastes good and where it came from and why it is sustainable, all of these different aspects of food that we here in the Willamette Valley are so good at understanding. The same thing, I believe, there's this absolute parallel with our consumption of news. We do not need a repetitious, continual, minimalistic, superficial regurgitation of stuff that's just separating commercials for the most part, or if it's in print or on the web, display ads or however else it's being paid for. If we just take our time and consume something that's a little more consequential, it's going to be better for us because our news diet, arguably, and I'll sure argue it, is almost as important as our food diet.
And so if thinking about it in food terms, what characterizes news that has nutritional value versus news that is empty calories?
Well, my favorite empty calorie story, which is in the book Slow News, Eric, is after things started to crumble for Gaddafi in Libya, there a boatload of expats, many of them Americans, were heading toward Malta to get out of the turmoil. And both Fox News and CNN stationed reporters with live capability on the shore over the ferry terminal in Malta. And they kept both of them breaking into whatever else their programming was, saying, there's a boat coming, and we don't know who's on that boat, and we don't know when it's going to arrive here, and we don't know if we're going to be able to talk to anybody when that boat gets here. And that continued and continued, very similar to another example I cite in the book, which was the night that the White House announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed by U.S. troops. And Geraldo Rivera was on the air. And as you well know, Eric, it's very difficult to fill time waiting for something in a live broadcast. But he went on and on speculating about what was going to happen. And he had all sorts of theories. And until the very end, none of them were that Osama bin Laden had been killed. So those two examples, what happened finally with the ferry was they were both able to say, and the ferry has come to the dock and we're not being allowed to go down to the terminal to interview anyone. Those are examples of exactly what we don't need, yet they're cleverly packaged to keep us there because something maybe is going to happen that we think we need to know right away. And in fact, we don't need to know it at all, probably, and we certainly can wait till tomorrow's paper.
So true. One of the other principles of the slow food movement that's very important is localism. How does that translate to the news business?
It translates really well. I don't know what happens at your house, but at about 5 in the morning, the New York Times, because I like the tactile reality of the paper, still gets dumped on my porch. And then sometime later, the Register guard, and for whatever reason, if the Baker family is listening, they won't bring it down to the porch. You only drop it at the mailbox, so I have to walk a block. Maybe it's good for me. Maybe they're doing it so that I get out, get some exercise in the morning. But the New York Times is providing me with this look that I appreciate of the world. What's spectacular about the Register Guard is that it's going to tell me what's happening at home. And the New York Times is never going to do that unless there's some catastrophic or extraordinary story of some type here. And so we need that. And that's why regional newspapers are continuing to thrive, even though newspapers are seriously in jeopardy.
They are seriously in jeopardy, in part because there's a new expectation in the digital world, which is that everything is free. And it's nothing is free in truth. It all costs money to make it happen. So is there a model you see developing that can keep journalism from being unable to be done economically because of that new model?
Well, that's one of the rules also, Eric. And I suggest that the onus is on us. And we should expect to, and on some level appreciate, paying for at least some of our news, because it does cost money. And if we're not ready to pay for something that is of value to us, then we're going to end up getting what we're paying for, which is something that isn't as good. We in the business have to figure out new models, but at the same time, news consumers need to be ready to pay. If you see a bum in the street, I guess that's not the politically correct term anymore, but if you see somebody in the street with their hand out, you may consider putting a dollar in that hand because you're thinking that's needed. There are other places where you can get something for free, like right now, an awful lot of news, where you might want to consider paying for the stuff that's one notch better. That was a bad comparison, wasn't it?
We'll do investigative journalism for food.
Is that you and me out in the street sometime soon? I hope not.
I hope not either. But, you know, one of the interesting things that's changed to me in journalism in recent years is that the myth of the objective reporter has somewhat been broken down. And there's more room for journalists' perspective, which I think is positive. But how do we balance that need for fairness and balance with the fact that the objective reporter doesn't exist?
Yeah, and the objective reporter, you're absolutely right, in my opinion, doesn't exist, can't exist, because none of us are objective. And to pretend, even to seek objectivity, is silly. Much better to look for clarity, fairness, accuracy, and to announce your prejudices, either overtly or obviously in terms of how you are reporting the news. And then consumers, and we're all news consumers, including those of us who are news producers, then we can pick and choose where we want to get this information, knowing what kinds of prejudices come with it. Sometimes those prejudices can be of great value and help us understand, again, a point of view that might not be ours, because if we just sit in this echo chamber of those with whom we agree, we're in a lot of trouble.
It seems like there should be a way to get much more beyond the echo chamber on a global level in this new world, too, because we have so many different sources available to us. But again, it seems like a challenge of finding and filtering, and which of us really has the time in the busy schedules to do the filtering that's required. How do we get that time into our lives?
Well, we've got to make some of that time if we care. But this is important. It's important to know what's going on. It's important to understand what's happening in the Ukraine right now, or in Ukraine right now. And there are, for those of us who are facile with English, we're really lucky right now because it is the lingua franca for the world. And we can find news outlets all over the world that are providing points of view other than an American-centric one in English. And perhaps we're lucky enough to know another language or two or three. And that again, is an example of where the onus is on the news consumer. We can't just passively sit in front of Huntley, Brinkley, and Cronkite. And if they were still around, or their equivalents, which are more or less still around, we shouldn't want to do that, because that had its own problems. Very narrow, an agenda that was driven by an establishment that would not necessarily represent the kinds of points of view that we would want to understand.
Not only as consumers are things changing, but as producers, certainly social media and the rise of the so-called citizen journalist has really shifted things. We are all becoming news producers in a certain sense in the social media world, wouldn't you say?
No, absolutely not. Because, sure, we're all information generators. That is absolutely for sure. We are vomiting out this massive amount of stuff, some of which can be considered of value. But I quote in this book a guy in Belgium who says, if you want to get your news from a citizen journalist, I'd like to introduce you to my citizen dentist when you need your teeth worked on. And there is a role, I would argue, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so pleased to be a professor down the street at the university in our School of Journalism and Communication. There's a role for the professional journalists, like it or not, whoever you are who's listening in your basement right now, whacking away on your blog, that's great that you're doing that, but there is a difference. And the citizen journalist, so to speak, has always been there. In radio, we always solicited what we called in the old days news tips, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember clearly working in San Francisco at the time of the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake at KCBS, and we began mapping where that earthquake was causing what by taking calls from the audience. And we were able to build the story in concert with the audience and with the emergency responders ahead of our reporters, because we didn't have enough reporters to get to everywhere. But that's not citizen journalism. That's professional journalists taking advantage of tools that include the audience.
Investigative journalism is a really highly developed skill that takes a lot of craft and a lot of money and a lot of things behind it. Indeed, it is not the same as citizen journalism, and that seems to be what's threatened by all the, quote, free things that are out there on the web.
Yeah, threatened by the free things and the things that just take up your time. It's different than when the Register Guard landed on your doorstep and you didn't have the option to get the New York Times not that long ago here in town, and you couldn't get the New York Times on any kind of a screen. And so your time with the newspaper was the Register Guard. Your time with the news was the Register Guard, maybe KPNW or whatever huge is, I always forget those call letters, or right here at KLCC. But now with all of this onslaught, we need some guidance. All of us need some guidance. It is so seductive, isn't it? I mean, how easy is it to just turn that machine on in the morning, kind of disregard the newspaper, slop your oatmeal down your throat, and try to decide which of this myriad of flashy stuff is going to grab your attention and provide oatmeal for your brain.
And what else for our listeners is essential about the slow news that will provide the oatmeal and the other protein and all the other nutritionally balanced news things?
Yeah, take a break from it. Just take a break from it. Pick some medium that maybe you'll just get rid of. I chose television. I only watch television when I'm in a hotel now. And slow it down. Literally slow it down. You don't have to hear every hour's newscast on the radio, even if you're stuck on I-5 trying to get into Portland. You don't have to subscribe to 7 newspapers if you're still a print fanatic or whatever it is. And you certainly don't have to have your email incoming being triggered by a so-called news break from whether it's the New York Times or whatever the guy is with the fedora. I'm missing all these names. Who's the guy? Drudge. And the other guy is Lars Larson. I knew I'd get his name before the interview was over, Eric.
Well, you and I were both living in the Bay Area in the glory days of Wes Scoop Nisker. And
yes,
that classic line of Scoops, you know, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. How does that feel to you down the line, that perspective? Is that still valid now?
Oh, it is more valid now than ever. And it is, it's not, I don't look at it as just a classic line. I steal it with credit in this book. And I think it's a directive that we all have to embrace if we are going to be social creatures that are reacting positively to our environment. We can't just passively listen to the news. We need to go out and make some of our own.
Slowly, perhaps.
Indeed.
Peter Laufer, whose new book is Slow News, A Manifesto for the Critical News Consumer. It continues his long career as author, journalist, broadcaster, documentarian, and educator. He's currently the James Wallace Chair in the School of Journalism and Communications at the University of Oregon. More about Slow News in book form via Oregon State University Press at osupress.oregonstate.edu. More about Peter Laufer at peterlaufer.com. For an extended version of this interview, go online to klcc.org. Thank you so much, Peter, for coming in.
A pleasure, Eric. Thank you, and thank KLCC for being exactly what I think we ought to be embracing when we want to engage in slow news.
Thank you so much. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen.